Hello and welcome to episode 19 of Meenal's World. I did promise part two just after I released part one, as soon as I could. I've had a lot on my plate, as you may understand, after giving birth, and the whole experience has been very emotional, very unique and very special. It's not something I can really talk about right now because I'm still processing everything. I'm still trying to understand what all of this means to me because so much has changed even in the last like 10 days. And when I first held my baby, when she was born on the 14th of July, she just felt like a toy. Like, I wasn't really sure like what to do with her. And then now I see her in such a different way because she's growing every day. She's becoming more cuddly and she's becoming a bit chubbier as well. But at the beginning, she was so tiny. I just didn't really understand what was going on. And I didn't really understand what the next few weeks would entail, because I guess it's just one of those things that you just learn on the job. And it always reminds me of my first job as a doctor, where I couldn't take bloods from anybody because I didn't know how to. I wasn't sure where equipment was. I didn't have the confidence to ask questions or do the research to find solutions to my patients' problems. But now with the baby, it's been pretty much the same thing, except for the fact that I've had to make the decision not to look into the internet too much, because I think raising a child is very unique to every individual and to every couple. So I'm just trying to go based on my experiences, my mother's experiences, and just a few people I trust, really. I think the internet is a bit of a dangerous place to go into. But I'm updating a lot on Instagram. I'm updating a lot of my thoughts, my feelings, my journey as a new mother, as a young mother, with my husband as well. And I hope you're all enjoying these updates, because I think just watching other people grow in their own journeys and experience new things is really important to sort of share that, because we're living in such a different generation where we're trying to do things in our own way. And it's quite funny, because when I spoke to Karina before giving birth, I remember telling Karina how I was afraid to even like breastfeed in front of my mom because I was so shy. We didn't have that sort of relationship. And now, I mean, my mom and I are just connected on such a different level, and we're so close. I'm so much more grateful for everything she does for me. So, you know, when you're younger and your parents say, you just wait till you have kids. I think I understand what that means now. I hate to admit that. But this episode with Karina was very special, because I did part two after giving birth and part one was before I gave birth. So I had a different sort of perspective now, because now I have my own child. And Karina talks about her journey, about trying to grow her own family. We talk about motherhood. We talk about how motherhood can be achieved in many different ways. You know, you don't have to genetically be connected to your children to be a good mother. Motherhood can take different forms. And that was a very eye-opening conversation for me. A very important conversation for many women who listen to this podcast as well. Many women who may be single, many women who can't conceive for whatever reason. And this episode is really, really important. Because Karina talks about her own difficulties and how she overcame them. And I tell you, I kept holding my breath every time Karina was talking about her journey, because I just wasn't sure if she'd reached the end of the tunnel, because she was always facing so many difficulties and so many obstacles. But she's a warrior and she's a fighter. And this episode will really bring you a new perspective on resilience. And we talk about how every obstacle she's faced has made her a stronger person. So I hope you enjoyed this episode, and I will continue to update all of you on my journey with motherhood, mainly on Instagram. And I might do an episode in the near future, maybe with my husband as well. So stay tuned and enjoy this episode. So welcome back, Karina, to part two. I can't believe I'm 9 days postpartum and I'm sat here doing this with you again.
I can't believe that you're here doing this.
But I had to, Karina. I felt like it was such a fitting time to have this conversation, especially with the experiences I've had over the last week or so. I think now I'm in the right emotional state to talk about it, because I think last few days probably was a bit too soon because I was too emotional. I think later on, because there's so much happening, I might just forget how I'm feeling. So I thought, you know, let's just get Karina when I can. And I've just managed to feed the baby. So if she's crying, it's my husband's fault, not mine. So how have you been, Karina, over the last couple of weeks?
Yeah, look, I've been fine. I definitely haven't just had a baby, so I have no complaints here. But we're good. It's actually, to be fair, it's been a bit of a roller coaster week since we've spoken. Last week we had a scan of the babies, so that was really lovely.
But before we get to that, Karina, I don't think we mentioned this in part one. We said that you were expecting twins.
Oh yeah,
we got to that. Yeah. So now you're mentioning the scan. So let's just take a few steps back.
let's not even worry about how my week was, and let's actually just record the podcast.
Yeah, we can talk about your week. I mean, I like it when my podcasts become therapy sessions as well. I mean, it'll benefit both of us.
I needed it this week. I needed it. My point was that we had a really good beginning to the week, and then I had a bit of a rough middle of the week because I had to go back into my oncologist because I found a bit of a lump in my boob and ended up having to have it scanned and stuff. So that was a bit nervous. It's always, you know, a really nerve-wracking time when there's something not quite right.
Yeah.
After you've had, you know, a cancer diagnosis. So I had a bit of a freak out, but we did an ultrasound and everything's fine. So
okay, good.
Back in the land of normality.
So what was that lump then? Was it just like a benign adipose tissue?
It was actually just probably just a bit of scar from my reconstruction. And just a bit of where the tissue itself is totally clean. Like they showed me the pictures of it and there's nothing funny there. It was just a natural sort of fold in the healing of the internal tissue or whatever it is that like.
Oh, I'm really, really glad that's all sorted. Yeah. But Karina, just out of curiosity, so when you found the lump to when you had the scan, what was the time difference?
Oh, like days. Like
really?
Like
all through the NHS?
No, I have private healthcare.
I was thinking, I was like, that sounds too quick. Like, usually people in the NHS wait a much longer time to.
No, I'm really lucky. I was treated privately through my employer because I had company benefits, private healthcare. Yeah. So I had actually my chemo was privately. And it means that if there's something. I mean, I have to say, though, I mean, when I called my GP and she saw me immediately because she was like, I know your history. She saw me immediately. And then she was like, well, go back to your consultant. And if you can't get back there, then I'll make sure we get you referred. So I think equally she would have been really good. She was all for turning it around really quickly as well.
No, but you know, Karina, I think I've spoken a lot about the NHS on the podcast over the last few months. And I remember my first guest, Ravine, who is also a cancer patient. And she went down the private route because she said the NHS was taking too long for her. And I remember speaking to her and saying that as much as I love the NHS, as a doctor, I feel stuck in this big system that I can't go the extra mile if I want to, because ultimately it's down to how the system works. If there's a long waiting list, I can't do anything about that, you know? I remember that episode, and now I look at my own personal experience with the NHS as a pregnant woman and my delivery. And it was almost perfect, I would say.
Yeah.
In terms of the information I was given, the care I had. But not everybody has that experience. And I think
that's the difficulty, isn't it? Like, it's very easy just to say the NHS is really slow or whatever. But I think it's the people probably have issues privately as well. You just don't hear about it as much. Probably. And it's just, you know, I always think when I look at myself and like the treatment I had before I switched to my private healthcare, or the ongoing treatment, you know, I see my GP really frequently, so I'm still getting that on the NHS. My mum is acutely unwell, like she's had heart failure herself, she's got lung disease, and I look at how she is treated through the NHS, and actually I couldn't fault it because she's seen when she needs to be seen, and the consultants are incredible. And in fact, we share a consultant. My cardiologist is the same. She sees him on the NHS and I see him privately.
Okay.
And, you know, you, the care is no different for the two of us, really. Yeah. You know, it's the same doctor and he's delivering the same advice and stuff. Mm. So, I'm really loyal to the NHS. I think it's incredible. And I think it's just like any other system that gets really big, it's going to get a bit slow and cumbersome. But yeah. I kind of feel like when it needs to see you urgently, it does see you urgently. And, you know, maybe like there are the odd circumstances where it's really slow, but
yeah. So I delivered my baby via C-section Tuesday morning, 14th July, Tuesday morning. And it was just that night for me that I had to stay in hospital, that one night. And I was in a lot of pain. I mean, I've just had major abdominal surgery, so it's understandable. Yeah. But there weren't enough midwives for all the patients that were in that ward. So when you ask for pain relief, okay. I mean, it took a long time for me to get there. But I don't blame them. It's just, again, the system is such that they can only employ a certain number of midwives and because they only have a certain budget. And, you know, it just made me realize that it's very difficult to sort of point a finger and say you're at fault or you're at fault. Actually, it's not like that. It's such a big organization. But then again, I came out the next day afternoon immediately. And since then, I've had very good care. So I think my perception of the NHS has changed as a patient because I've always seen it through the eyes of a doctor. So now it's changed. But anyway, going back to what you were saying about your week. So you mentioned that you had the scan and of the new members of your family, we can say.
Yeah.
So the last time we spoke, Karina, you mentioned that we spoke about surrogacy and we spoke about how, you know, having a child in your life meant so much to you and how you went down the route of planning for growing your family. So at what stage did you decide to go through surrogacy again?
So the second time round, it was not long after we'd actually become parents to Amala, my firstborn. We obviously had the initial period where we really settled in to parenthood and stuff. And we were in touch with Ina, my surrogate, throughout. So always just checking in. I was conscious that, you know, she's given birth to this baby, but she doesn't have the baby with her. So I wanted her to make sure that she had visibility of the child, that she, you know, it wasn't just like, oh, thanks for the baby. And we then decided to set off on our lives. It wasn't like that at all. She was, you know, we would send her pictures and we would stay in touch. And, you know, we actually, when Amala was 6 weeks old, we went to register her birth, and we have to do that in the town that the baby's born in. So we were back up in Ina's hometown. So we arranged to meet with her that day, and she came to that registering of the baby and stuff. It was really lovely. So we'd kept in touch, and we'd sort of said in jest, like over a message of some sort, and she just, or it was in person, I can't remember, and she was like, oh yeah, I would do it again, but only for you. Like in that, she would do another surrogacy journey, but only with us.
Yep.
In that she wasn't up for the whole getting to know you again and all of that time that needs investing to form a relationship with a new couple. Mm-hmm. So, I just, you know, after a while, said to her, like, "Were you serious? Because, you know, I would love another baby. I never really planned to stop at one.
Yeah.
It was always our intention to have more than one child. I think we're Indian and really used to extended family and big families. Mm. And I myself am, you know, I'm one of two. My husband's one of two. And we've always loved like the family gatherings and having that closeness with siblings and cousins. So I kind of probably even before Amala was born, I always saw my future with more than one child. So it just meant that we had to start thinking relatively early on what we were going to do in terms of bringing a sibling into our lives. And we knew it wasn't going to be straightforward. So we discussed with Ina, like, you know, if we were to go again, like what would be a reasonable time frame? And like, we would wait at least 1 year for her body to recover and, you know, her to have enough strength and for her family to have had some family time before we then fall pregnant again. So we knew we would wait at least a year. And then I guess the year passed and we continued to have conversations, and, you know, we'd met up with Ina a couple of times and just, you know, said, look, are you still thinking it would work on a sibling journey? And she said, yeah. You know, the only thing is I would love to do it before I'm 40. So that's in 2 years' time. So,
oh, right.
Let's think roughly about dates. Mm-hmm. And so it was always on the radar that we were going to look for a sibling journey. And I guess then the question was how we would create that sibling, knowing that we didn't have any embryos of our own to use to make a sibling. And I can't remember if we discussed that last time.
Mm-mm.
Did we? No. We didn't, did we? So what had happened was
I don't remember you talking about not having embryos for this second trial that you were planning.
Okay. So what had happened was when we transferred the embryo for Amala, when we arrived at that clinic, we had 11 day one embryos. So we'd created embryos in 2013. They were fertilized and frozen at day one. And then we went to our fertility clinic with the journey with Amala, and we were advised that we should defrost all of them, grow them to 5 day old embryos, because that gives the best chance of success for pregnancy on transfer. And then at the end of, once we'd got them to 5 days, look at which one is the strongest, use that for transfer, and everything else would need to be frozen, refrozen, ready for another journey. And so that was all what we had planned. And when we did the transfer to Ina that day, I'd spoken to an embryology team and they had said, your embryos are looking good. You've got four or five that are really strong. There's one particularly strong one that we've picked out for transfer today. And the rest of them need to be refrozen. We're going to leave them a little bit longer, see what they do, and then we'll refreeze them. And that was the plan. And that's what we always thought was going to happen. And the day after transfer, I called the clinic just to see how many they refroze and wasn't able to get through to anyone, and thought, oh, that's really weird. Normally there's always someone in embryology who can answer my call. That was a Friday, didn't hear back. Then I tried again on the Monday and didn't get a call back. And on the Tuesday, ended up calling the clinic manager and just saying, look, I've been trying to get in touch with you guys since Friday and no one's told me how many embryos you've refrozen. And I just really want to know for my own peace of mind. And she put the call through to embryology, and I got a call back a little bit later, and a lady who I'd never spoken to was on the other end of the phone, and she just said, oh, Mrs. Duman, I think you might be a little bit confused. And I was like, confused about what? And she goes, oh, I've been told you want to know how many embryos we've refrozen, but we didn't refreeze anything. Everything was allowed to perish. And that was exactly my reaction at the time. And I couldn't believe the words that she was saying. And I was like, no, I think you're confused. There was clear guidance that our embryos had to be refrozen. I have no option to harvest eggs again. This is these were all that we had of mine and my partner's genetic material combined for now and forever, sort of thing. And she just said, well, no, we didn't keep anything. It's all gone. And I just kept thinking, I hope this is an error. I just hope she's got it wrong. I hope she's reading someone else's notes. But I remember exactly where I was at that point in time, where that phone call, where I was in my house, and I just sort of fell to the ground and I had to hang up the phone and I cried like I've never cried before, because to me, that was my chance of having a child just taken away from me. Mm. That was, you know, I'd almost been dreaming of a sibling for Amala before Amala even existed, because I'd always thought, I've got 11 embryos, I will be able to have two children from them. That's just where my head was at. And I didn't for a second think that the thing that would stop me from having them would be a clinical error. I always thought that, well, if they don't survive, then that's fine. I've tried as hard as I can to bring them to life. But this was like someone had taken that choice away from me without our permission.
And it can't be undone either. And there's no alternative to that.
No, there wasn't. And it was absolutely heartbreaking. And I felt really alone at that point, because, you know, I called my husband and I told him, and when he came back, we were talking, you know, I couldn't stop crying and I kept saying to him, I can't believe what they've done. And he just said, it's okay, we'll find another way, we'll find another way. And I became very angry, and I thought it's, and I actually used to say it to him, I go, it's very easy for you to say we'll find another way, because you can genetically father another child, I can't. You will not know how I feel, because you can be the biological father of another child, I cannot be the biological mother of another child. Like, and I wasn't resentful to him, but I was very angry, because then I was angered that, you know, my health meant I couldn't do it again. This clinical error meant that my opportunity had been lost of a biological sibling for Amala, and it really hurt. And at that point, we didn't even know that our surrogate was pregnant, because it was literally 3 days, 4 days after transfer. So I, as soon as I'd spoken to Sati after that call, I called Ina, and she just said, oh, did you hear from the clinic? Because she'd also been calling me, just saying, you know, Karina, what are they, where's, how many have they refrozen? Like, I want to know, because if we go again, it would be really nice to know how many we've got. And I rang her and I was like, you're not actually going to believe what I'm about to say to you. They've thrown them away. They've just discarded everything that we had left. And she couldn't believe it. And she was like, how can that happen? You were in the room with the woman. Like, you told her. And I was like, I know. We've had a whole conversation about it, and something's gone wrong, but we don't have any other options. And she was just like, well, this embryo better stick. Like, this has to work. There's no other option for, you know, this cannot not work. Like, the embryo inside me is the only embryo you have.
So at this point, when they had told you they had discarded what you thought they had frozen, at this point, your surrogate mother was already, they already implanted one embryo into the surrogate mother.
Yeah.
But you only had that string of hope that that would work. And if that didn't work, it was game over.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah, that's where we were at. And it put an immense amount of pressure on her.
Of course.
To hope that that transfer resulted in a pregnancy.
So how long after the transfer, so once they've implanted the embryo into the surrogate mother's womb, how long does it take to know that the pregnancy is a liable pregnancy?
You wait for 10, well, it's 10 days, 10 days, and then you'd have a blood test to measure your HCG levels, to see if that resulted in a pregnancy. And we'd received this news 4 days, they said, Saturday, Sunday, Monday, 4 days after.
4 days.
So we still had 6 days to wait.
Oh, right. Those 6 days must have been the longest 6 days of your life.
What happened was after the phone call we'd had on the Tuesday, I think the next 2 days were really difficult and we were in a really dark place. But quite quickly, I think it's probably my nature, I realized that I had to actually pick myself up and just channel positivity to Ina and this potential baby that she was carrying, because the negative energy wasn't going to help anyone in this current situation. And we almost had to park the issue of what happened with the other embryos while we focused on bringing the one that we still had alive to life.
So Karina, before all of this, you've obviously been through so much with your breast cancer, your heart failure and your hospital admissions. Now those experiences were obviously very difficult to go through. In any way at all, did those experiences help you deal with this one in particular?
I think what helped is probably the resilience I've built up over the years.
It's like a muscle, isn't it?
Yeah, and mine gets tested an awful lot.
Yeah.
So I think it was sort of my resilience, and I'd always, through my sort of, it's once I'd come to terms with cancer, I'd realized the power of positivity and the power of the mind, and I had, you know, I'd really got into mindful practices and meditation and, you know, channeling my energy for good. And I think that really helped me at this point, because it stopped me from becoming, and I could have very easily spiraled into anger and, you know, real frustration and probably even hate if I allowed it to. But I consciously reined that back and just said, this isn't the time and there isn't space for that, because we've got to put everything into manifesting this embryo into a baby. And that is all I did from that point on. Like, from then until Amala was born, all I focused on was making sure she was healthy and making sure that she arrived safely with us.
So what was how did you deal with the fact that they discarded your embryos? I mean, because that's something that's like not acceptable. Did you have it's any not, and time I... or energy to deal with that as well on the side? Because
I mean, I raised it with the clinic managers and I told them that I was really dissatisfied. I'd had one meeting. I went back to the clinic and had one meeting with them where the head embryologist tried to explain to me what had happened. And he turned around and said to me that he had had a personal family crisis that had taken him away from the workplace. And he's left someone else in charge and there was perhaps a communication error, but didn't ever fully hold his hands up because he just sort of then turned around and said, but your embryos might not have made a refreeze and they may not have ever actually taken if you did another transfer anyway. Yeah. And I just said, well, it wasn't about whether the embryos were a good quality or whether they did or didn't take, you know, on a second transfer. It was about my choice and my rights being taken away. And actually, even if they were poor quality embryos, it was my choice to pay for storage for them. And it would be my choice to try and transfer them and my choice to try and bring them to life. It wasn't up to you to take all of that away from me.
I think the thing about it now is like you literally threw life away.
That's how I feel. That's how I feel. That's like, I sometimes think people must think I'm a real drama queen, but to me, that was my children. Like, you literally killed everything I had. Yeah. Of being a mother to those. And I struggled. And so, you know, I didn't do much after that. I purposely didn't do much because all I wanted was the one baby that we had to be born and to be healthy. And I didn't want the negativity to overwhelm or overshadow that in any way. And then once Amala was born, I started to look into it again. And I raised it again with the clinic and sort of have gone through now, and it's still live now, a formal complaints process. Separately, I sought legal advice on where I stood with this. But the bottom line is because we found another way of becoming parents that we have no right to sue for embryos that were damaged because we've still remedied our pain, which I think is really bad. And I find that really soul destroying.
It is,
because it almost says that they weren't worth anything. And just because we found a solution, it doesn't mean that there shouldn't be justice for those embryos that were discarded, but it's the way the judicial system works. And we've been told that there wouldn't be any point in taking this to court.
Really?
Mm.
So what was the solution then to grow your family?
So the solution didn't come overnight.
Sorry, Karina, just for our listeners, just for clarity, this whole experience happened with Amala, your first child.
Yeah.
So
this all happened in 2018.
Right. So this happened when you were trying to start your family with the first child.
Yeah.
They had told you they had discarded the embryos, but they had already implanted the surrogate mother with the embryo. So you were just lying on that hope. Now we're talking about your growing your family, but you don't have any embryos.
Yeah.
So what was the solution to that, Karina?
So the solution was a lot of work on myself, a lot of coming to terms with everything that happened. I spent a good amount of time almost counseling myself to let go what happened to those embryos and acknowledge and accept that, you know, my ultimate belief that everything happens for a reason and, you know, whatever has happened. And again, it's probably built from my previous experiences of acceptance of these things that happen to us and not fighting them. I almost had to accept that this was always destined to actually happen. And I had to find another way. So I then started thinking about what I would do and pretty quickly felt that if I had another child, I would want it to be my husband's genetics, even if it couldn't be mine. So rather than consider adoption or those options for parenthood, we first thought we would like to look for an egg donor and use, you know, my husband to fertilize that so the two children would at least be siblings through his genes. And, you know, we would still have that opportunity to go through the whole pregnancy and, you know, the birthing of new life that was as close to something I would do myself had I not had all of my issues. So that was the route we knew we would take, but we didn't take it lightheartedly. Like, there was a lot of conversations between me and Sati about how we would feel with having one child that was genetically ours and a second child that we would look to conceive via egg donation. I definitely would spend a lot of time in my own head, you know, on my own, just thinking, look, am I in a position to love a child that's not biologically mine the same as I love this child that is biologically mine? And I would actually then look at every relationship I had with children, not just my daughter, but like my nieces, my nephews, my friends' kids. And I look at the love that I have for them. And I would then just say, look, Rena, look at how much, like, if anything happened to the parents of any of these children, would you sweep them up and call them yours if you had to? And absolutely I would. And, it, you know, and even looking at Amara, I don't love her because she's biologically mine. I love her because I've nurtured her from the day she was born. And she, you know, I've grown her and I've been her mom. Like, and what I've now realized is that genetics don't make you a mom. It's everything else, you know. It's that child knowing that you're their protector and you're their comfort and you're their provider. And it doesn't matter whose genes make me a mum, because what I realized was that motherhood isn't what we are brought up to believe it to be. Like, you know, and I never in my upbringing heard of anyone who became a mum through egg donation. Like, I've never heard of it. I had heard of one story of someone in our family, distant relatives, becoming parents through adoption. But all I had known was that they had hidden that adoption. So I had never really... Yeah, and I had never been exposed to this, you know. Embrace it. It doesn't matter how you become a mum. Like, you are a mum. That's all that matters.
That's really interesting, Karina, because you hit a very good point there. When I hold my baby every day, I never actually think this is mine. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, I never think, oh, she's got my genes, or she's got... I mean, sometimes I'm like, okay, she looks a bit like me, or like, you know, those sort of things. I've never looked to her in such a way that this is sort of my property, or my my bloodline, or this is my genes going down. I've never looked at it like that. When I look into her eyes, and when I play with her, and when I spend time with her, this is a baby. I want to grow into something so great, and so, you know, to grow into this amazing person. Not for me. Yeah.
And it doesn't.
It doesn't matter.
You want her to make the best version of herself.
And I'm saying this to you, Karina, as someone who's just given birth and she's genetically my child. That's something I've never even thought of. So for you to go into this new path of motherhood, you know, it would be. It would be something that would be quite normal for me as well, actually.
Yeah. And I think that's it. I think it's just that we're so conditioned to believe that motherhood is a certain thing, that it's only when you're forced to stop and step back and actually question what you yourself believe motherhood to be and what you perceive it to be is the only thing that actually you need to come to terms with. And I quite, you know, once I decided and once me and Sati had had the conversation that, look, if we want to become parents again, we're going to have to look for a donor. Once we'd had that conversation, it was just about me accepting that, you know, I was going to be a mum in this other way. And actually, that was totally fine.
Yeah.
Like, for me and him, that was totally fine. And like just like you say, I don't love my daughter, Amara. I don't love her for the DNA that runs within her. I love her for her as the person that she is. And that's why I know it and why I knew it would have been absolutely fine to become a parent through egg donation.
And did you have, because I mean, talking about your feelings and your emotions as a woman going through this must have been quite difficult to explain to your husband, right? And it's not his fault. It's a very difficult thing for anybody to understand, because your husband would ultimately be the biological father of this child or these children, but you're not in that position. So what kind of support could your husband offer at that point?
He would just always tell me that it was like that I was making up problems, because I was constantly like, I was just scenario planning almost, but it was right too, because I was just like checking that I was comfortable with every eventuality. Like, you know, like, what if people just keep telling me that she doesn't look like me? Would I take it personally? Or like, what if someone said out of ignorance that she's not yours, because to them, genetics makes someone a mum. So I would always keep thinking about what are these things that could happen that could just throw me off, like, you know, that could make me question my feasibility as a mum. Mm. And then he just kept saying, why are you so worried about that? Because you know it's fine. Like, so he was almost like, he was on board and he didn't see any issue with it. And I think men are very much like that, aren't they? They're not like going to go looking for 101 problems. If there's a solution, they're like, yeah, I'll take it. I don't have to worry about every other problem that could potentially come my way. Like, he was happy and he was comfortable. So it was very much like he just allowed me to go through that process of making sure that it was the right thing for me to do.
And was it?
And for us to do as a couple.
I was going to ask you, Karina, sorry to interrupt. I wanted to ask, was there any support groups available for you at this stage? Because a lot of women must have got, a lot of other women may have gone through something like this.
I think there probably, maybe there was, but I wasn't drawing upon them. Okay. I think I said this the first time that I'm quite a person that if I'm in a situation and I have a gut feel of what I need to do, or, you know, I have a view, I really like to make sure I cement my own feelings and make sure I'm comfortable with my choices and then bring in other people's perceptions afterwards, because I don't like to be influenced by other people when I'm making really important decisions about my own life. And I like to just try and like hum out all of that sound and that background noise. Mm. And I just like to focus on what I think I need to do, make sure I'm comfortable with it, and then seek external counsel once I think, okay, I think this is what I want to do. Now I'll go and get advice on whether anyone else thinks there's other things I should look at, or I don't know. I'm very much just sort myself get to where I need to. That's right.
Sorry, carry on. I'm not going to cut that out because that's just life and people need to know that my life isn't perfectly running. Yeah, sorry. Go ahead, Karina.
Yeah, that's fine. So I didn't draw on support group as such, but what I had looked at is when I was in the surrogacy world, when we conceived with Amala, that and we used our own embryo, that's called gestational surrogacy. Yeah. So it's the couple's DNA implanted into someone else. Now, in surrogacy, there is another form of surrogacy that's called traditional surrogacy. And traditional surrogacy is where a surrogate uses her egg and the sperm of the intended father. So in that circumstance, the mother is not genetically mother to a child. So I had been sort of surrounded by all of these amazing intended mothers who have become mums through traditional surrogacy, and knew that they all had really powerful connections to their children. You know, that there was no, and in these situations, like the surrogate is almost using her egg, or she is using her egg, growing it into a baby, but that baby becomes the child of the intended parents. Mm. So there's a real link between the surrogate and the child, but there's the intended mother is still always the mum. Like, there's no questioning that. So because I'd seen that, that's egg donation in a different form. And so I had been comfortable with that sort of.
And you seem to have a very good relationship with the surrogate mother of Amala. So did that help in bringing your confidence? And
yeah, well, I mean, I think. Ina and I had a conversation about whether we would look to have to do traditional surrogacy for our second, knowing that we needed a donor. But it wasn't something that she was comfortable with because she had never really gone into surrogacy thinking she would give her eggs as well. She would always just seen it as using the couple's genetics. And in the end, when I had had conversations with Sati, we really thought that we would have actually liked to have a donor who looked a little bit like me. Our first choice would not have been a white egg donor. And there were reasons for that, not really reasons that are, I want my kid to look like me, because face it, Amala doesn't actually look like me and she is my genetics. Like, it was more because I think, I was really mindful that if we brought a child in through egg donation, that one child would have a different biology to the other three members of its family. And I wanted to do what I could to make sure that that child was comfortable with its own identity as it went forth in life. And I kind of know the community I'm from, and I know that we look at families and we sort of, you know, you'll see a family across the road and if they look a bit different, you'll be like, oh, I wonder if that's their kid, or I wonder if that's, you know, it's just, it is just what people do. So I I wanted a donor that looked like me, just because it would save the child a lot of questions as it grew up into an adult. Because if it was half white and half brown, it would look significantly different to me, Amala and Sati. And it would probably spend, that child would have most of their lives, people at some point in time would probably question who their parents were. And I wanted to take that away. I mean, people still might do it in the future, but they might do it a bit less if we all look the same. And so that was my gut feel. My gut just said, look, it would be really nice if you could have a donor that looked a bit like you. And then the other thing that I realized very quickly was that, like, my relationship with my surrogate was incredibly and is incredibly important to me, like, for the long term. These people are part of my life, like, forever. And I felt almost the same towards a donor. So in England, if you go through egg donation, you don't get much information about your donor other than eye color, hair color, skin tone, build. You don't get much more than that. You definitely won't know who it is who's donated that egg, and you won't ever meet the donor. And I almost really wanted to meet the donor, because in the same way that I love my surrogates for making a mum, I would love my donor for making me a mum. So I also had this view that I wanted to meet the person who would be my donor. So there was two things I looked for when it came to my egg donation journey, and that was, one, someone who had a similar skin tone to me, and two, someone who I could potentially meet. So I wanted to do known egg donation. And then that meant that I had to go overseas, because I couldn't do that in England. I couldn't have a known egg donor in England from an agency or anything like that. I mean, I guess if I knew someone who was willing to donate an egg to me, then I could do it. But I couldn't do it with a stranger, so, or go through an agency and get a known donor. So I had to go overseas for that. And I started looking into what our options were. And with the help of people, actually, contacts that I had made through the surrogacy world and people who were doing their own research for other reasons, found an agency and a clinic that were based in Cyprus who had a lot of UK clients go over there because of their success rates with IVF, or because of the donors they had on their books, or for whatever reason people travel overseas to make babies. And so I got in touch with this clinic, and I was, you know, I had a coordinator, and I was telling her what I wanted, and I said, look, I want a donor, I want to know who my donor is, and then I'll be having a surrogate carry this embryo once we've created it. So I'd be bringing her over, and these are all the things I need to consider when we're talking about this journey. And she was like, okay, that's fine, we can help you. And she was amazing, like, in putting me at ease with the whole, like, overseas clinic thing, because I knew nothing about it before I started on this path. So she was just telling me about how the clinic works. I think because we'd been through a round of IVF and surrogacy transfers, I was more familiar with the process. So when she was telling me, you know, you'll come over at this many days before transfer, and this is what will happen, and these are the scans, you'll have to have some meds while you're in England, and we'll prescribe them, or blah, 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 I was very familiar with that. So that made me comfortable very quickly. And then we talked about donors, and she said she worked with an agency and she could get me some profiles of potential egg donors. And I said, look, my number one thing is I would really like a colored person, you know, a person of brown skin, if possible. And she said, we do have some donors of color. I'm going to have a look if there's, you know, what the match is to you, and let me see what I can find. So she started sending me through some profiles. And the first few profiles, like, there was a mix, I should say, at this point. There was a mix of people with white skin and brown skin. And I looked at all of them. I probably paid more attention to the people with brown skin because that's kind of what I was angling for. And then I just read the profiles and saw if I felt any of these girls would be right, because I'm really a person who lives from my gut and my gut feel, and I just believe that what's right is right. And there were a couple of girls on there that I said, look, maybe this person, maybe this person, but I'm not so sure. And it just actually so happened that the two people that I had shortlisted, but with a little bit of I'm not sure sort of view, weren't available anyway. So she was like, oh, look, this person's just actually matched with someone else, so she's actually not available at the moment. And then this person's on a break at the moment, so that's not possible. And like, I let it be, and I just said, let's just see what comes up over the next few months. I'm not in a mad rush for this, like, I just need, you know, I'd rather have the right donor before we rather than pushed her for anything. And then she randomly said to me, look, there's one other girl who is absolutely amazing, and I think I'm going to send you her profile and let's just see if we can make it work. So she sent me her profile and I looked at it, and visually I was like, yeah, that's she looks pretty much like me, actually. So I said, yeah, that works really well. But as I read her bio, within 2 minutes of reading it, I knew that she would be the woman that I would choose to get to use as my egg donor. Because the word it's well, so she described herself as she said something like, you know, I love being playful and having fun, and I realize like that's the importance in my life, but I also have a serious side to me. I'm driven, I'm blah blah blah. And she was very much like me. I'm really driven, but equally I love being crazy and doing silly things with my friends, and I'm very lighthearted. So that was really resonant. But then what sealed the deal was that she used a line at the end of her bio, which is almost one that I live by, right? So one of my things is that if people don't laugh at your dreams aren't big enough. And she had written that if you're not afraid of your dreams aren't big enough. And that was that was on the last thing. And I was like, oh my God, like I have to at least see if she's available, because there's so much about her that I just love the vibe of, and like just really enjoyed reading her profile more than anyone I'd read before. So I went back to the lady and just said, look, is this donor available? And she came back and she goes, well, she's available right now. She's looking to take on a new job and she might be moving in a couple of months. So if she does do a donation cycle, it kind of needs to be done within the next couple of months. And I was like, oh, I'm not actually, like, I wasn't expecting for things to move so quickly. We were just sort of exploring at this point. But it then became a thing of, like, we were working to the donor's timeframes. And because of that, everything started moving really quickly, because we just knew that we wanted to use her. So pretty much within the next, I think it was within 6 to 8 weeks, we found ourselves, like, we found ourselves getting payments sent over and getting her medication sorted and getting our flights sorted. And, you know, in the middle of, I think it was August, was it July or August of 2019, we wound up in Cyprus, me and Mara and Sati, ready to create embryos. And we'd only made contact with a clinic like 3 months before to just start exploring.
Do these clinics provide emotional support as well? Or do they offer... No. Right, so it's just get the job done.
I don't know if they do. I never asked for it. Yeah. they might do it, but
and you know, Karina, you mentioned that at the beginning you were worried about how you were always thinking about the genetic makeup of the next child that you wanted to have. Did this feeling change throughout your experience going to Cyprus and speaking to these people, or does that still, is there still like that cloud over your head?
No, it's not there at all.
Yeah.
It's like, it's gone. I think it was probably, it was there before we started our sibling journey, and it was always a question mark. But I think as soon as we found our donor, that question mark was gone. And as soon as the embryos were created, that was it. They were mine. Like nothing, even now, like I actually wouldn't think of them as someone else's biology. Yeah. I just think of them as my babies.
So now these embryos have been implanted or transferred to Ina?
No. So then what happened?
Okay. Wow. Okay.
No. So we were ready to, and we'd been speaking to Ina about the fact we'd made these embryos, and we'd been talking to Ina about transfer dates, and we'd said we would look to go in December or January. So December 2019 or January 2020 was our aim for transfer. And Ina was looking at her calendar for days off and stuff, and we were really on that path of Ina was going to carry the sibling. Then I went to Turkey on a retreat for a week and decided I just needed headspace and like counsel with my best friend and, you know, disconnected myself from the world. And the day I came back, well, the day I was leaving that retreat, after manifesting this family, like every day I would sit on a mountain and all I would manifest was my family, like coming to, you know, completion. And I turned my mobile phone on after 7 days just to get the flight details for my journey home. And the first text I saw was from Ina, and she had sent me a really long message, and it basically just said that she had to unmatch with me for personal reasons and that she wouldn't be able to carry our sibling for Amala. And it was another one of those cry my heart out moments.
My heart just sank when you said that, because it's like every time you see that light at the end of the tunnel, something happens.
Yeah. Something does happen, and this is what happened. And I knew how long it had taken me to get to know Ina. I knew how hard it is to form a relationship with someone, and to even meet someone. You know, it's not easy as intended parents to match with a surrogate. It takes a lot of time and effort, and you have to invest so much of yourself in it, and you have highs and you have lows. And I was just like, it all came crashing down, because we just created these embryos so extraordinarily. Like, you know, the donor was from South Africa. We traveled, a woman from South Africa to Cyprus. We'd gone from England to Cyprus. We'd created these embryos, and we'd gone through this whole process. And then we now had no one to grow these embryos for us. And it was gutting, like absolutely gutting. And we came back to England. And the worst thing I wasn't with my husband, so I couldn't even tell him, right? And I didn't want to tell him over the phone that this had happened. So I just held it until I got back to England. And then I came home and I said to him, "You're not going to believe what happened to me on the last day of the retreat. We got this message," and I read it to him. And he was so upset. Because we'd sort of imagined ourselves as parents within the year, because we'd agreed that we would transfer in a few months, and we just didn't see anything really going wrong. And so we were both gutted, and then picked ourselves up as we do, and just figured out what are we going to do. And in that time, Ina had messaged a few more times, and you know, she herself was really upset. So, you know, and it's important to acknowledge that it's not her fault. You know, and she didn't owe us a sibling journey. And if her circumstances changed, that's absolutely okay.
Do you know exactly what had happened, or?
She just said she had some stuff going on in her personal life and with her own health, and she didn't want to risk being pregnant. And I've never really delved deeper than that, because I don't think that's my right, really. She doesn't owe me, and she doesn't really owe me any more explanation than I will or I won't do it. And I think over the years I've learned that, and I've learned that I have to let go of control, and I have to just surrender and accept that this is just the way life is for us. And there's no point in holding grudges. And she then came back to me going, "I hope you don't hate me." And I was like, "Dude, I can never hate you, because of you, I'm a mom. Like, you know, I will never hate you. I'll always love you."
So
exactly.
You can't forget that.
No, I'm never going
to. Your frustration was probably based around the fact that you would have to go through another process
It was nothing personal. And I said to Sati, like, the most important thing right now, when we were in the midst of that, was making sure that Ina didn't feel like she'd let us down, and that we were going to pick ourselves up and keep going, because she didn't deserve to carry the burden of our sorrow, because it should never have sat with her anyway. So we got over it, and I chatted to Ina a fair bit, and I was like, "Look, don't worry about it. We're going to be fine, and I'll go back out there. And if a match is meant to be, it's meant to be, and whatever's meant to be is meant to be and stuff." And so our relationship is still perfectly fine, and we still get on with each other just fine. But it was just, like a frustration that we're back at square one when it comes to finding a surrogate again. So I went back out onto the forums in the autumn of last year and just started socializing and said to people that, you know, I'm not matched anymore. I've got embryos ready in Cyprus.
Was it quite an urgent sort of thing? Like, did you have a time frame where you had to find a surrogate mother? No, it was okay, right? Because they were frozen.
No. Yeah, okay, they were frozen. Fine. So,
but did you have that? Were you racing against time in your head because you didn't want Amala to grow too old, or like, did you worry about age gap between children?
Initially I did, and that's why, you know, we'd already set the dates. But I think once we knew I was back to looking for a surrogate, I just let it go. And I was like, "Look, it's fine." Like, because the embryos are frozen in time, it's not like I'm a woman who's losing her fertility the older I get. It's like, you know, I've got these embryos, they're frozen in time, they're not going to degenerate. So it's just a case of us finding the right person to carry them. And I am like still an advocate of making sure you have a good relationship with your surrogate. I wouldn't rush into a match just because I, you know, something went wrong. I'm not going to rush into it because I know the importance of a good relationship with your surrogate. And, you know, at the end of the day, I host a podcast about how you do surrogacy correctly. Yeah. So I would not be, I'm not the sort of person who would advocate just finding someone for the sake of it. Like that wasn't going to happen. So I resigned myself and, you know, Satty and I both acknowledge that it could take another year before we even matched with someone, and that means that when we thought parenthood was coming within 1 year, it might come in within 2 years. But we just had to accept it, and we'd gone through so much to get to the point of we knew we wanted to be parents that another 12 months wasn't gonna be a barrier to us. So I went back on the forums, I reintroduced myself, and I just said, look, circumstances have changed, and you know, I'm now unmatched and we have embryos ready, blah, blah, blah. We're looking to get chatting to people to see if we potentially meet another match and stuff. And I just went on through that process of being really really active on social media and making sure people knew about us, knew about our story, knew about me as a person. Because by this time, what I also learned was that I was really confident in myself and in me as an intended mother, because I had lots of friends who were surrogates and they were like, Queenie, you're such a nice intended mother. Like, you know, you treat your surrogate so well. And I knew we had treated Ina so well. Like, we weren't a couple who would let her go without anything. We always made sure we cared for her because she was doing such an amazing thing for us. So I went into this knowing that, you know, I'm a member of this community. I've got friends in this community. I've had one journey behind me. I have this podcast that I, you know, launched, and actually this community means a lot to me. So as much as I need someone to help me, I would be a really good IM for any surrogate to match with. And I had a level of confidence that I didn't have the first time around, because the first time around I was just nervous and thought I was competing with the whole world for someone to match with me, and it was a different mindset. So I went into it, and you know, unbeknown to me, I think some of my friends who I've made in the surrogacy community were also sort of rallying around trying to see if anyone was looking for a match and line me up almost with people they knew. And then what happened was that I got talking to a girl who is a friend of a friend, and my friend who introduced her was one of my really good sort of go-tos on our first journey with Amala and Ina. And I used to always sort of just sound things off against her. If I was unsure, I would just be like, oh, what's the, you know, how do you think about this? Or what should I be doing for Ina at this point? And we were really good friends. And then when it came to the second time around, she goes, I'm just going to introduce you to this girl. She's been a surrogate before. And I think you should just get chatting and see how you get on. And so we did that. And we started talking and we got on really well. And we arranged to meet up sort of at the back end of 2019. And because we had a friend in common, it was very easy to trust and get to know each other rather than sort of two strangers meeting, because we had that commonality of someone who we both trusted. We almost trusted each other a little bit more than we would have had we been total strangers. So we got on really well in the December. And then she said, look, I want to meet your husband and I want to meet Amala. Let's make that happen. So in the January, the three of us met. Amala and Satty met with her and her little boy. We got on, like, there was no real issues there. Her and I had been talking almost daily at this point, and we were like being very honest about everything that was about to happen and honest about what we expected from a surrogacy journey. So the second time we met, we went through a surrogacy agreement just to check if we were on the same page. If we were to sort of take this to the next step and officially match with her. And the three of us sat down around the table and looked through the agreements. And again, we're very happy with everything in there. There were a couple of points that we had discussions about and then came to a mutual agreement on what we wanted and what we felt would work for us as a team. And sort of really soon after that, we just officially matched with Laura. And so this has all happened like within 5 months of me unmatching with Ina, and it happened very quickly. And I was like, wow, I didn't expect it. But
it's probably your previous experience that allowed you to probably work at a different pace.
Absolutely.
And,
yeah,
you know, you've probably removed all the anxiety. Once you remove all the anxiety and uncertainty, I think it was probably a lot easier to get through that. So how many months pregnant is your new surrogate mother now?
So she's 5 and a bit months pregnant now.
Right. So, and
we travelled out.
Yeah. Sorry, carry on, Karina.
Yeah, no, so we travelled out in February of this year to Cyprus.
Just and that before was, again, lockdown.
Yeah, and that was mental because we were meant to go in March, April. That was what Satie and I had planned.
Oh, my God. Then, I just can't imagine another obstacle coming in there now.
No, I know. And it just so shows this was meant to be. So she basically said to me, Karina, do you mind if we go a month early? Because it would be great if I wasn't really heavily pregnant at Christmas time. Like, I just would love to have had the babies by then so I can enjoy the Christmas with my own children. And I was like, look, I'm fine on timings. If we can get it to work, let's get it to work. So, that's what she did. Like she knew her cycles really well, so she contacted the clinic herself and said, look, I would rather do this in February, so can, and given in mind this was now January, so she wanted to go the following month, she owned it, and she just said, Karina, we're going to go in February. Like, and I was like, okay, fine, I'll book the flights, let's just go.
Yeah,
so we got on a plane in the middle of February, and you know, we came back, and like, what was it? It was like we came back on the 15th or 16th of February, and then 10 days later, found out that we were pregnant. So she'd come back and she'd done pregnancy tests, and they obviously showed positive. So, that's what happened. And then, you know, literally a week or two after that, we were starting to the world was starting to lock down. And had we not traveled at that point,
Karina,
in time,
I can't imagine, like, just stop there, because if I just even imagine that scenario, I think I'd just break down into tears and just end this recording right now, because it's just.
So, but yeah, no. So obviously, but, you know, the great thing that happened was that we were pregnant in February, and you know, like, fortunately, whilst we've all been trapped at home, Laura's been baking.
Baking the babies, yeah. The lasagna's
babies,
in the oven.
Yes. That's... Yeah, definitely. So there is more than one of them, yeah.
Where is Laura based right now?
So she lives in Northampton.
Oh, Northampton. Okay, that's where I work.
Yeah.
So now just one quick question, because I understand that lockdown has affected not just pregnant women, not just new mothers, but also people like yourself. Because you haven't been able to go to scans or meet her or just see her bump grow. You know, all of these things must have been quite difficult for you. Because I'm sure from your angle, you'd want to be there to, like, nurture her and take care of her and hold her hand in the scans.
Yeah.
And you haven't been able to do that. And, I mean, I went through the same thing as a mother, as a pregnant woman, that I didn't have my parents around. And it's only now that I have them here with the baby that I realize how much I actually needed them, because this is my first pregnancy. So for me, this was new and to some extent normal as well. I was like, this is how it is. But it's only now that I've realized, and I don't know if it's my pregnancy hormones or postpartum hormones, but I've realized how important it is to have family members around and people who really care about you, especially at a time when things are quite sensitive. And I'm sure carrying twins is not easy. And I'm sure from your end as well, you've been through a lot, so you will always worry about something or another. So what was that experience like?
It's been hard, like, and especially because we've had one normal pregnancy with Amala and Ina in a normal world where we could be there and we could share as much as we want, to then going to this point in time where, and I think the main problem was because of my heart disease, I was shielding, so it wasn't always the fault of the hospital that we couldn't get there. It was sometimes because of my own illnesses I couldn't go to a scan. So actually, when we had the 12-week scan, yes, it was just Laura who was meant to go, but actually she spoke to the nurses and the team at the hospital and just said, I'm not the mum of these babies, and every other baby that comes into your ward to be scanned has their mother there by default, so it's not fair that the mother of this baby is not allowed to be in the room. So she actually really fought for it.
Wow, and she sounds like a boss.
She is amazing. Yeah. She's absolutely amazing. And she has now negotiated that I'm allowed to go to scans. So I was there at 20-week scan. I wasn't there at 12-week scan because of my own health issues. So we were there at 20-week scan. We've since had another private scan done, which is the one I was talking about you about a moment ago. But what the frustration is that people at the moment are having private scans so that mum and dad can be in the same room as baby when they can't do it in a hospital setting. But we can't even get that in a private setting because it's always surrogate plus one.
Right. So why did you arrange a private scan?
So that Sati could see the babies because he hadn't seen them at all since 6 weeks. So that I'm allowed to go into the hospital environment, but he's not because obviously he's a dad and no dads are going into scans at the moment. So he hadn't seen the babies at all since we had been for a six-week scan, it was probably a bit later than that, but a very early scan. Yeah. He hadn't seen them at all. So we did the private scan so that he could go in and he could see the babies.
So that was a nice part of your week.
Yeah, that was a nice part.
And then you had that
bit
of a scare with the lump on your breast.
So, but we're all, you know, we're still living in the joy of the nice part because that was wonderful.
That's amazing. And that's the thing, Karina. I realized that, you know, we spoke about resilience earlier and we spoke about experiences. And I think, I mean, I might talk about this in a few episodes when I feel ready for it, but I'm still processing a lot of things like my own relationship with my own mother. There have been a lot of times where it's been quite traumatic for me and for her. We've had lots of ups and downs. And I think that's in the past. But now we're making such nice memories together. I think that is sort of making less room for those times. Because it has been tough between my mother and I, especially because we've been raised in very different generations. She was raised in India, I was raised here. So our thinking is quite different. But now we're on such a good level together. Quite possibly because of the birth of her grandchild. And that's what I see as the beauty of bringing this new life to this world, is that she doesn't know what she's done. You know, she's created new bonds and new relationships between people.
Children are amazing at doing that. We had fractured relationships in our household before Amala was born, and all of them are healed because of her.
Really amazing.
It is. And I think us as mums and people who raise children, we become less worried about ourselves and our own egos. And actually, we just see the world for what it is. And we see these beautiful, vulnerable little lives that come and bring joy with them. And you reassess what's important in your life. Yeah. And you realize that actually it doesn't matter if you've annoyed me 10 years ago, because that was 10 years ago. This is today.
Yeah.
And today this life is here and we should all be celebrating it. And it makes it so much easier just to let go. And once you start to let go of all that pain and that hurt and that, you know, negativity that's weighing us down, we become so free and happy, and we can just enjoy and cherish every moment that we have with these babies who come into our lives. So
what I was just getting at was that creating these nice memories with my mother now is making less room for the difficult times we've had together. And I'm sure it's the same with you now. You know that you've been through a lot. And Karina, the reality is we will face difficulties in our life. I mean, it's not like we just get through life in a breeze. But I think the more time we spend making these really nice memories gives less space for the traumatic times we've had. And I think lockdown specifically hasn't allowed us to create these happy memories. So we've been for like 4 or 5 months, depending on which part of the world you are, where we haven't had a chance to go out, meet people and speak to different people and create these happy memories. So we either dwell on what's happened, or we're just sort of fixed in this constant state of mind where we're just either depressed or jaded. So I can imagine what it was like. I can't imagine what it was like for you, because there's always so much to look forward to meet Laura, to meet the babies, to meet the bump. But that was taken away from you because of lockdown.
That's been the tough bit, because we, like with Ina, we would meet periodically and we would just have lunch or dinner or something, and we would just see we'd have really long chats about how she is and how she's feeling, and then we would try and, you know, have time to see if we can feel the bump and feel any kicks and all of that and watch the bump grow. But we've not had that. But you know, and even when I did go to the scan with Laura, I was like, oh, I'm not meant to touch the bump, and she was like, oh, sod it, just touch the bump, like, do you know what I mean, just, it's fine, like, you know. And I was like, oh, that's not 2 meters, but you know, it's fine,
just hold your breath,
I'm gonna touch it. Exactly. I took a face mask, I was like, I've got a mask on, it's fine.
That's lovely, Karina. And I really hope now things are just happy memories for you, and
Yeah, I mean, there's obviously still going to be issues. Like, there's still questions about the birth, you know, who gets to be in the birth? Because, you know, if it's only the person giving birth and their birth partner, it means that mum and dad aren't there. Mm. So me and Satya are at risk at the moment of not being at the birth, or only one of us being at the birth, or there's lots of stuff.
But you know, those are things that you can worry about later. Just enjoy now that you've managed to see the babies. You can see the bump now. You can meet Laura. The small things you'll figure it out as you go along, Karina. I'm sure.
I hope so.
You're very capable of figuring things out. So I wish you all the best with everything, Karina.
Thank you
for joining me for part two.
That's right.
And I feel
we'll do part three when they're here.
When they're here, yeah, we'll just keep going. And part four when I have my next child.
Exactly. Just keep chatting.
Yeah. No, it's nice to have an adult conversation, because I've just been doing baby talk for the last week, and I thought I was almost incapable of speaking to adults, but you've given me that confidence.
You've done
again
a really good job, dude. Like,
thank you.
Honestly, I can't believe you've had a baby 9 days ago. Yeah. Just recorded another episode.
No, we need to keep going, Karina. We need to keep these episodes going out. And you're doing a great job with your podcast as well, and your advocacy for surrogacy, and you know, raising these conversations in our community especially. So if people want to contact you for any advice, how can they do that?
So the best place is to find me on my Instagram, which is just at Karina Dhiman. So KRENADHIMAN.
Okay.
And then if you want to listen to anything surrogacy related on all of your normal podcast channels, so Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, you can find our podcast called The Intended Parent. So that's just The Intended Parent. And there's also an associated Instagram page of the same title. So you can find us on there as
brilliant,
well.
Brilliant, Karina. And thank you again. Hopefully we can actually physically meet at some point.
Yes.
With Amala and Radhika as well now. So
that would be so nice.
Thank you so much, Karina. And take care and all the best with everything.
Thank you. And good luck with Radhika.
Thank you, Karina.
See you later. Bye.
And thank you, dear listeners, for tuning in. I hope you enjoyed that episode with Karina. I could do a part three, I think, with her. And hopefully, as she grows a family and she goes on with her journey, it'll be great to have her back on. I love catching up with guests. And I do that quite a lot, actually, just off the record sort of thing. I've been speaking to Ravine, Just Breathe, Isra, Rina, a lot of the guests who've come on the show before. I love staying in touch to see where they are in their journey. And hopefully we can try get everybody back again soon once I've settled down and once I get into routine and release weekly episodes as promised. So please do follow Karina on her Instagram and show her all your love and support. She's an amazing, amazing woman. And you can follow her journey as well. And I'm sure it will inspire all of you guys as well. That's my baby who's just started crying in the background. So I guess I need to end it right here. stay tuned for more episodes. And please do follow me on Instagram as well, at MealsWorld. And please tell all your family and friends to tune in as well. So hopefully I'll see you next week.